I thank Shruti Dharma Ji for allowing me to enter the temple premises, and also to thank Naveen Krishna Prabhu for inviting me here to work further on the wonderful projects of the Avanti School Trust. Okay, what do we have here? We have 434, right? You know, when you get older, the senses start fading in terms of effectiveness. So I have two sets of glasses. Isn't that great? But hopefully there's another kind of vision that gets sharper as the outer vision gets duller. Yeah, the other one's for computers. This is for reading. So, okay, so what do we have here? 34. Ah, okay. Well, this is actually a text from the Rasa Panchadhyayi, the five chapters of the Ras Lila. You know, what I think I'll do is just, in the interest of time, just read the text myself. Okay? Anugrahaya bhaktanam manusham deham ashritaha bhajate tadrashi krida ya shrutva tat paro bhavet. Krishna manifests his eternal human-like form and performs his pastimes to show mercy to the devotees. Having heard such pastimes, one should engage in service to him. And there's a short, actually, very long purport. Okay, let's see what we can do here. This text is from the Srimad Bhagavatam 10:33-36. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has innumerable expansions of his transcendental form, who eternally exist in the spiritual world. This material world is only a perverted reflection of the spiritual world, where everything is manifested without inebriety. There everything is in its original existence, free from the domination of time. Time cannot deteriorate or interfere with the conditions in the spiritual world, where different manifestations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are the recipients of the worship of different living entities in their constitutional spiritual positions. In the spiritual world, all existence is unadulterated goodness. So in the Trigunya scheme of things, the gunas. There is, of course, sattva, rajas, and tamas, but Prabhupada here is talking about vishuddha sattva, which is in a category beyond the three. In the spiritual world, all existence is unadulterated goodness. The goodness found in the material world is contaminated by the modes of passion and ignorance, or rajas and tamas. Well, I have too much to say just about that to go on, but let's see if... Here the Sanskrit is just beautiful. Anugrahaya. So this is the word anugraha. Anugraha. I have a special relationship with this word because after I'm leaving here in London on Wednesday, I go up to Sweden, where I'll be lecturing at Uppsala University, which is Sweden's Harvard. You know, that's their... Oh, you all don't know what Harvard is. Okay, they're Cambridge. Okay, we'll just leave it at that. Okay, you understand that. Okay, so and I'm lecturing on discoveries that I've made in the Yoga Sutra. Discoveries that reveal a theism, a powerful theistic content in the Yoga Sutra, where most people have supposed that there is not. And recently I've signed a contract to publish a translation of the Yoga Sutra where these discoveries will be sort of laid out. But what's interesting here is that I went to an academic conference and where I was a respondent to the two top scholars in the world on the Yoga Sutra. And I was to respond to their papers. And their theses were basically similar. And they were saying that there is no theistic content in the Yoga Sutra. There's no real mention of divinity. What to speak of bhakti? I mean, without divinity, you don't have bhakti. Without Bhagavat, you don't have bhakti. So here I was in front of, you know, these very formidable scholars, very intimidating people, of course, not to me, but to most people. And so when I responded to their papers, they did not give me their papers beforehand, which is normally the case. So I had to respond in an impromptu fashion. So I was challenging them. I said, how can you say that there is no sense of a theism in the Yoga Sutra when you have several instances in which you've got the word Ishwara? Ishwara. And, you know, I think Prabhupada typically will translate the word Ishwara as Supreme Lord. Many translators in the West will translate it as God. God is not a great translation because God has the sense of a creator God, as in the beginning of Genesis in the Bible. So there are several instances in which the word Ishwara appears and even describes a kind of discrete supreme being that is known as Ishwara. But they were denying that this was a theism. And later in the discussion, I realized that they're really denying it as a theism because of the way theism is so narrowly discussed in the West. It really is that particular God, that Abrahamic God of the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and the Quran. And in that sense, they were correct. We don't really have a creator God. Remember, I mean, Brahma sort of, you know, Krishna sort of subcontracts out the creation stuff, you know. It's sort of a task that Krishna really has nothing to do with. And then cosmic dissolution is taken care of by Shiva. So Krishna's not that involved with creation and dissolution of the cosmos. Something to hand out to other people. And that's why Krishna is known as Nimitti Karana, the efficient cause. And boy, is Krishna efficient. I mean, he really is. He can be playing in Vrindavan and all of this cosmic creation and dissolution is taking place without any effort. But later I argued with these scholars that there is a concept that's subtle but so powerful in the Yoga Sutra, a concept of anugraha, which is this word here, anugraha. I'll explain what that means in a minute. Because there is a sutra text in the Samadhi Pada, the first of four padas. Samadhi Pada. You see what Patanjali does in the Yoga Sutra? He immediately gives you a picture of perfection. Yogic perfection. And close to the end of this one quarter of his text, he talks about the meditator as a grahitra, which means one who grasps. One who grasps. So meditation is not this passive thing. It's not this passive thing where you just kind of sit there and wait for you to sort of get lost in the universe. But rather, it's something that you're grasping. You're grasping the object of meditation. And if there's an object that is over and against you as a subject, as a meditator, which means immediately there's a nice setup for a theism. You know, you can't have an object, oneness or, absolute identity of everything is not an object. But a deity, a divinity is a beloved object. So Patanjali describes the meditator as a grihitra, one who grasps the object. And then another permutation of that word, grah, is grahana. And then there's the grasping, and then there is the grahya, that which is to be grasped. And what is so unavoidable in my thinking is that these are morphological sort of variations of the verb root grah, which means to grasp in Sanskrit. So in meditation, we're grasping, we're seeking, we're desiring that object. And of course, the result of this is anugraha. Can you hear the word grah in the word anugraha? So this is the word, practically, besides prasad and kripa for grace. So the grasper, the grasping, and that which is to be grasped is responded to with anugraha. That which follows the grasping is literally what anugraha means. Anu, the prefix. So I just think that is gorgeous. Don't you? Well, it's Sunday morning, a little early for all of you, I think. Anyway, later you'll appreciate it when you think about it during the day. Anyway, anugraha. Anugraha. By the way, my legal name, first name, is Graham. That doesn't mean you go around, trying to grasp me, okay? But I just thought I'd throw that in for, old time's sake. Graham. In fact, many Indians with an Indian accent will say not Graham, but Graham. Graham. So whenever they ask me what my name is, I always say Graham Baba. And they like that very much. Yeah. Also in yoga workshops, I'll say my name, Graham Baba, anyway. But I'm thinking of this text in the Yoga Sutra. So anugraha, anugraha. You see, in order for meditation to take place, or in order for devotional service to take place, there is a necessary precondition, which is the existence of a divinity. A divinity that not only contains all, a divinity that not only pervades all, but a divinity, amazingly, despite the fact that such a divinity may pervade everything, desires our love. So divinity is full, purnam, right? Om purnam ada purnamidam, right? Purnat purnam udachate. So there's fullness in the universe. And despite this fullness, there is this longing and this yearning on the part of divinity for the one thing he doesn't have, at least in my case, is our love. That is the only thing that he leaves completely alone. Because as soon as you try to manipulate or control or coerce or sort of maneuver, even gently, it is no longer love. Love is not something that can be forced. It is not something that can be arranged for. It's something that is offered from the heart freely, out of attraction, out of a desire for greater closeness and intimacy with the beloved object. And by the way, in case any of you don't already understand this, we are a tradition that celebrates love. I mean, if you're here for liberation, if you're here just to get out of the material world, you know, if you're here just to practice austerities, you should leave right now. There you go. There's a door. I sense some of you around here are... Yeah, you, right? Yeah, no. Okay, I got the wrong... You. No? Okay, anyway, I'm feeling like there's some sort of mokshik-oriented person here. This is not what we're about here. We are a tradition that celebrates the absolute beauty and power of divine love. I mean, it's just that simple. And in anticipation of Gaur Purnima, by the way, a lot of people say Gaur Purnim. Please get the A on the end there. It's a long A. Gaur Purnima, okay? Gaur Purnima coming up. When we talk about Krishna, we say we worship Krishna. I'm hard-pressed to think of any temple in India or the world where when you open the curtains, only Krishna is standing there and nobody else. Have you noticed that? I have never seen just Krishna standing there, except in some yoga circles, maybe. They do that. But that's because they don't know Krishna very well. He has friends. He has divine personages with whom he likes to connect lovingly, deeply, and supremely. So when we think of Krishna, when we're saying we worship Krishna, actually saying the name Krishna, if we read the Chaitanya Charitamrita carefully, specifically and especially in chapter 4 of Adi Lila, Krishna Das Kaviraj explains when you say Krishna, you really are saying Radha Krishna. He explains that they are identical, and yet they're two. And he then explains that they become again one in Mahaprabhu. So there is this interesting sort of movement between one and two. That's sort of this tension between it's where our achintya bedha bedha philosophical vision begins. This is the very beginning of it. It's where Krishna and Radha become one and they become two. And in Mahaprabhu, they become one. Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radha Krishna, Nahe Anya, in the Bangla, saying that Sri Krishna is none other than Radha Krishna combined. So when we celebrate, when we honor Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we're doing something very special. We are honoring the embodiment, the very embodiment of the love that's transacted between Radha and Krishna. So again, if you're after anything else here, you really, you know, should leave. I mean, really. We are a tradition that celebrates love, that celebrates the love of Radha and Krishna. We're, you know, I had to even invent a word in the academy to describe our kind of theism, because most theisms are more like deisms. Deism is when God created everything and then he split. In fact, if you read the Hebrew Bible, you'll notice that God is very present in the beginning. He's really quite around. He's walking in the garden, you know, hanging out. I mean, he's there. I mean, it was a gorgeous garden. I mean, it sounded, the way it's described, it sounds very, very sort of Bruja-like. I mean, I hesitate to say stuff like that because I don't want to equate the two traditions, which sometimes we're all too inclined to do. We're too quick to point out that, you know, that God the Father in the Christian tradition is Krishna. But I don't, you know, see anyone calling out to Krishna as dad. You know, we just don't really think of Krishna as father. Anyone here do that? I mean, that's too personal, right? That's fine. If anything, you think you're the father of Krishna, if anything. You're taking care of Krishna. I mean, at a center like this, we're extremely busy taking care of Krishna. Have you noticed? Everyone's running around, right? There are people running around right now back there. We're still taking care of Krishna. But Krishna's taking care of us. That's the anugraha, the grace. Grace. How does this grace manifest? Grace manifests first by his fullness and yet his amazing yearning for us. That yearning takes the form of a flute or a call of a conch, as in the Bhagavad Gita we were talking about the other day, right? Calls, the call can take many forms. It can take the form of his teachings. I believe I counted in the Bhagavad Gita 22 times over the 700 verses. Okay, now there's proof. There's more than just Krishna on here, right? And yet it's all Krishna. I have counted in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, and no fewer than 22 times does Krishna evoke the sense or the message or directly the words, come to me. Come to me. Look, if I'm sitting out in the hall, you know, and I say to one of you, come to me. Well, you might not hear me the first time. So I'll say it a second time. Come to me. You still might not hear it. I mean, saying it three times is a lot, right? But if I'm out there saying it 22 times, I mean, that must mean I really, really, really want you to come to me, right? So there is an intense yearning that Krishna has for souls. He really wants us to come to him. He is full, but yet he is lacking something, which we have. That is the necessary precondition for bhakti. Bhakti is this bhagavat ishta, is primary, this desire, ishta. When Krishna so powerfully announces the greatest secret of all that he has. Sarvaguyatamam bhuya shrinu me paramang vachaha. Ishtosi me dridhamiti tato vakshyami te yatam. This is where Krishna says, hear again, because I've been trying to tell you this for at least 500 verses. I'm embellishing this, of course, right now. For at least 500 verses I've been speaking this. I'm a very generous divinity. I'm not a jealous one. I'm a generous one. I've even encouraged you to worship other divinities. If that's really what you want, that's what you love right now, I will even help you, he says, right? But come to me, he says. Come to me. This should be haunting us. He says, this is the greatest secret of all. And if that weren't an underscoring enough, my supreme message, paramang vachaha. And then he puts it in quotations, ishto si me dritam, you are so much loved by me. The word ishta, loved, it also means desired. I desire you. Did you know that Krishna desires us so much? It's right there in the Gita. Prabhupada will emphasize devotional service, but he talks about how Krishna will, he's ready to reciprocate with us. Yayata mam prapadyante tangstataiva bhajamyaham. Bhajamyaham, I love you. I will reciprocate with you, he says. It's pretty intense stuff, right? If you think that's intense, then it's time to contemplate, you know, the love between Radha and Krishna. That is the most intense. Krishna plays the flute to attract us. It is said that parts of the Gayatri Mantra are actually the sound of Krishna's flute. So those of you who chant the Gayatri Mantra, just be aware of that. The Krishna's flute, he's calling us. So this is our process. The process of bhakti is to come to a place like this and to begin to hear Krishna calling us in various ways. With the music of his flute, through the hearts of his bhaktas, through the, you know, I mean, notice they're looking at us. They're looking at us. When they're not looking at us, they're engaged in Leela. But when they're looking at us, they're calling us. And when Krishna's playing the flute, generally speaking, he's not with Radha or any of the Vrajagopikas. But here he is with Radha. So on the one hand, there would be no need for him to play the flute. But together, Radha and Krishna are calling us. Now, how amazing is that? And then, if that were not enough, Krishna comes as Mahaprabhu Gauranga and shows us how to get really crazy when Krishna calls us. Really crazy. I mean, Mahaprabhu goes nuts. I mean, he's out of control. Just read the Leela, the Chaitanya Leela. He is sometimes the love that fills his form is so overwhelming, his form begins to deplete. It becomes contorted. And what this teaches us is that as a bhakta builds this reservoir of love and devotion and that he or she can offer to Krishna and Radha, soon the body is just not a proper vessel. Death becomes a kind of vehicle, you know, where one says finally, like, I can't stand being so confined. I'm claustrophobic in this place because I've got so much love for Radha and Krishna. I've got to get rid of this thing. It just gets in the way. The body is getting in the way. So Mahaprabhu really taught us this. He taught that at a certain point one accrues so much affection for divinity that really a release from the body is a welcomed event. Don't worry, I'm not going to die right here on the asana. Okay, you won't have to clean anything up. Okay, just want to cause it. Besides, I have a little more to accrue. I mean, it's not that devotees are walking around going up to, you know, one another saying, Prabhu, I can't wait to die. I can't wait. I want to die. No one is going around. I mean, I don't know this temple that well. Anyone doing that around here? A couple of you in the ashram? Yeah? Yeah? No? Some brahmacharis? Okay. No, okay. I don't know. Yeah, okay. Anyway, but that would be a good sign, right? So our bhakti process involves something very parallel to what Patanjali spoke of. This, we are graspers. We are grasping. We are wanting to embrace Krishna, for he has embraced us. He has been waiting an eternity within our hearts for us to return his embrace. So we are embracers. In this sense, grasping is an embracing. And there is this mutual embracing. And embraces really say two things. When you embrace, when we embrace each other. So when I saw Shruti Dharma this morning, I hadn't seen him in a long time, I gave a nice big hug. Right? And what I'm telling Shruti Dharma in that hug is, one, I love you for who you are. I accept you. I embrace you. And that's pretty big of me, right, to accept Shruti Dharma for who he is, right? Maybe you don't think it's that big of a thing, but that's fine. So I'm embracing Shruti Dharma. I'm loving him for who he is. At the same time, in that embrace, I'm also saying, I want to be even closer to you. I want to know you more. I want to associate with you more. So that's the nature of an embrace. And that's the nature of Krishna's embrace. He embraces us with his multiple manifestations of Brahman and Vishwarupa and Paramatma or Purusha. But he's already embracing us, saying, I already accept you the way you are, but I want to know you more. I want you to be closer. Come to me, he says. Come to me. You are desired by me. It's not as though that we go up to, you know, Krishna Loka and we knock on the door and Krishna answers the door and says, look, I'm busy right now. I'm busy. I have my leelas. You know, it's evening time. I'm about to go out to the forest and track the gopis. So I really don't have any time for you. But you can make an appointment with Uddhava. He doesn't say that. I know what will happen if I show up. He'll look at me with shock, like, I thought you would never come. That's what he'll say to me. Some of you will say, I've been expecting you. Yeah, I know you've been coming. But Garuda, no. I can't wait to shock Krishna. Surprise Krishna. Hey, guess what? I'm here. That'll be nice. Prabhupada says, and this is a common phrase, that things in this world are perverted reflection of what is in the spiritual world. Let's try to understand that phrase, a perverted reflection. I think what Prabhupada, the word perverted is a little strong, but there's some sense in which in this world things are distorted from the original archetypal spiritual world from which this world comes. So there is distortion. But things in this world are rooted, ultimately, in the spiritual world. Don't forget that. I was like the image of a lotus flower that is famous. There are many words in Sanskrit for the word lotus. One of being pankaja, pankaja, that which arises out of the muck. Lotus flowers are famous for, just this beautiful stem and then this blossom that is exquisite, rising out of very mucky, murky, sluggish water, like a swamp. Not very pleasant. Nothing you'd want to swim in. So the metaphor is beautiful, right? That out of this world can come such beautiful things, like bhakti, like our bhakti sangha, our connection with the hearts of devotees and the hearts of all living beings. There can be such beauty in this world too. In fact, I was reading sometime in the middle of the night, I don't know, my sleep is all messed up, but I was reading about the Hladini Shakti, the potency, the very potency for love, of which Radha is the most intense and supreme embodiment. And Prabhupada was saying that from this Hladini potency, we also have love in this world. But it can be tainted. Sometimes it can be very dark. Prabhupada would often paint a picture of love in this world as very dark. But it doesn't always have to be that dark. It can, there can be lighter shades, and we can notice people in this world that can be very loving. And we should always, you know, encourage that. Because there just ain't enough love in this world, let me tell you. Ain't is a slang contraction we use in America. I don't know if you use that here. I'm in a very foreign land when I'm here. You have to understand that. In any case, this world, like the reflection of a lotus flower in a murky pond, the reflection of the actual blossom is also beautiful. It's also beautiful. The only problem is when we try to pick a blossom from the water, you can't do that. The real blossom stands outside the water. But the reflection of the blossom is distorted. It's a perverted reflection. But it's still beautiful because it's still coming from the original lotus. So there's still much beauty in this world. But under that reflection is the murky water. So there's a lot of ugliness in this world as well. It's a very mixed world. But let's not discount what is beautiful in this world. Even Krishna in the Gita talks about the way he is present in the superlative parts of the creation. Right? Chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 10. The Vishwarupa. So there is much beauty here that we can appreciate and engage in Krishna's seva. And here, of course, we're engaging all kinds of beautiful things in the Lord's service. So it is the celebration of what is beautiful, what is playful, and what is delightful that we as bhaktas are focused on. So even in this world, what is beautiful, what is playful, we notice that children love to play. It's natural for children to play. Well, where do you think they get that from? Krishna. Have you noticed he's very playful? He's very playful. Look at him playing. Well, in this case, he's playing the flute, but that's playful. He's very playful. He's also very beautiful. He's very delightful. These three attributes come from the three primary deities of Vrindavan. Madan Mohan, beautiful, in the sense he attracts all souls with his beauty. It also corresponds to Sambandha Jnana. Right? So he attracts souls to him with the playing of his flute, by his beauty, by the beauty of the music he makes, by his beautiful countenance. Govinda is the manifestation of playfulness, and it corresponds to Abhideya. And devotional service ultimately is very playful, it's spontaneous. It's wonderful. It's buoyant. And then Gopinatha. Gopinatha, the Lord of the Gopis. Where he is delightful. He is full of absolute delight. The delight of love between himself and his devotees. And that is, of course, corresponding to Prayojana. And I'll just end with a thought on a very key phrase that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami uses to understand the appearance of Mahaprabhu in relation to Radha and Krishna. He uses this phrase, Rasika Shekhara. This appears at least four times, at least twice or three times in the chapter 4 of Adi Lila. Rasika Shekhara. Prabhupada translates it in one place as supremely jubilant. Krishna as supremely jubilant. Another place, he translates it as the foremost enjoyer of loving exchanges. Rasika means, you know, one who is absorbed in rasa. Rasa, rasika. And shekara means foremost. Like shika. Shika, top, most, right? Shekara means supremely high, the greatest. So he's the greatest he is supremely enjoying the rasa. But as Krishnadas Kaviraj points out, he noticed that Radha is enjoying it even more. That's his problem. What a problem to have, right? So he is mystified. He is absolutely mystified by Radha's level of bliss within their rasa. He is mystified by this. He's dazzled by it. And he wants to know it. He wants to understand it more. And as the Bhakti Sutra says, that if love is to be love, then the lover must be sensitive to what it is that the beloved experiences. Otherwise, it is lust. Love means I am sensitive to what my beloved is feeling and thinking. I want to know. I'm sensitive to this. So Krishna is trying to be sensitive to this. And it's so baffling to him that he wants to take the form of Mahaprabhu Gauranga to appreciate Radha's divine pleasure. Externally, it is explained that he comes as a devotee celebrating Sankirtana. So outwardly, historically, he was a figure who danced around all of India. And selectively, he was very scholarly also. He would speak to the likes of Prakashananda Saraswati, although he didn't speak very much. He just sat there and glowed with his love. He just glowed. You see, I would do that with scholars, but I don't know how to do that. See, I don't know how to glow with this, you know, this love that just pouring out of everywhere, you know. So I tried it once. It really didn't work. I'm not going to even give you the details. It's pretty much a disaster. Then there's Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. I also tried to do what Mahaprabhu did with him, and it didn't work. You know what he did, right? He sat there for 7 days and seven nights and just let Sarvabhauma talk himself out. And he was known historically, by the way, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is known even today by historians as one of the most prominent Nyaya logicians. So I also tried this with a colleague of mine. I couldn't get past 4 hours. I really couldn't. I just, any more than that, I was going to explode. Really, it was intolerable. But 4 hours, I mean, give me credit. Come on. I'd like to see you sit in front of this guy for 4 hours, you know. But Mahaprabhu, 7 days, seven nights. No, not even close, right? Then, of course, there was Keshava Kashmiri Pandit, you know, with whom he talked Sanskrit poetics. He actually showed Keshava Kashmiri a faulty conception of poetics. So he used the discipline of poetics to give Keshava Kashmiri a greater realization of what is truly beautiful. And of course, it was grounded in Krishna Bhakti. I tried doing that too, and I'm not going to even get into that. So the point is that Mahaprabhu is a marvelous example, not to be imitated, like I tried, but to be followed, to be inspired by. Mahaprabhu's external role in this world was to establish Sankirtanam, the collective and perfect calling out. Kirtanam means both two things. It means to praise when in one's presence and to call out in one's absence. And whenever there's a feeling of extreme missing Krishna, absence of Krishna, there amazingly is a kind of palpable presence that is experienced. And the reverse is also true. So kirtanam is both celebrating the presence of the divine and the absence of the divine at the same time, each one intensifying the effect of the other. It's very powerful. I have a lot to say about that, but that's another time. But internally, this is the embodiment of the love of Radha and Krishna, basically bursting in the form of Mahaprabhu. One of the things I wrote about in the book I finished for Tamal Krishna Goswami, which I've lectured here in the past, and I'll just end with this, which is the special... There are people, there are other sampradayas that worship Krishna Bhakti, that practice Krishna Bhakti. It's not as though we're the only ones to practice Krishna Bhakti. I said earlier, in a disjointed way, my talk is rather disjointed today, but that I had to invent a term to describe our theism. I never gave it to you. I call it theistic intimacy. Because mostly when you talk about theisms, it's this God that's detached, that's disconnected from the hearts of living beings. But Krishna is always embracing us, even now as we sit here. He is always embracing us. It's a question of whether we can experience the embrace. That's all. It's whether we can return that embrace ultimately after we experience it or recognize it. So theistic intimism or intimacy describes this very intimate transaction between a living being and a divinity that is so imminent, that is so present, that is so personal. So in this theistic intimacy, we're practicing something very special. Our sampradaya, though, because of Mahaprabhu, recognizing Mahaprabhu, is a very, very extra special anugraha, a very special grace. Because Mahaprabhu is a manifestation of Mahabhava, which is a supreme distillation of Hladini Shakti. It's an ultimate and supreme and unattainable intensification of love of God as Mahabhava. So it's not as though one day, you know, I'm going to, you know, show up here and see Naveen Krishna and say, "Hey, Naveen, guess what? I have Mahabhava." No, he's never going to hear that from me or any of us, because that is only for Radha and Mahaprabhu. So how is that advantageous for us? Well, in Goswami's book, in the end chapter on Prema, I compare Mahaprabhu as a geyser, as waters that come, you know, erupting out of the earth in a beautiful fountain. And his love is like that. In fact, Mahaprabhu's love was very eruptive and frankly disruptive. I mean, it was just explosive, like a geyser. So while we will never be, you know, experiencing Mahabhava, but we get to bathe in the waters formed around that fountain of Mahabhava. That's special. We get the spray from Mahaprabhu's explosive fountain of prema. That is real anugraha right there. That is very special. Now, it's not as though we should go to other Krishna bhakti, you know, sampradayas and say, hey, you guys are missing out. Well, I'm sure they have special things too. But this is very, very intensely personal. This is why we chant the Pancha Tattva mantra before chanting the Maha mantra. What are we doing? We're dipping into that little, those little pools of formed from the spray of the fountain of prema. That's what we're doing. Just be aware of that. You're taking a little dip into the pools of spray coming from the fountain of prema. And it's with that that we then chant the Maha Mantra. And this is a very, very special gift.